liberate the oil-rich province from Saudi-backed militants. Thousands of people rally in Mali's capital Bamako to protest French military presence in the African country. Also in the headlines, the Canadian government appeals a court ruling on individual welfare compensation to Indigenous children. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mears. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army has made further advances in Mareb province, taking control of a military camp near the provincial capital. Yemeni forces captured the Rish camp after fierce clashes with Saudi-backed militants. The camp is located in the Juba district, south of Mareb province. The Yemeni army also gained control over the Jarsha district. These are the latest in a series of gains that the Yemeni army has made in recent days. Since last year, Mareb has turned into a focus of the Yemeni army operations. It is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces. Anti-French sentiment is running high there, where thousands have come out to protest the foreign military presence in the West African country. The demonstrators flooded the streets of the capital, Bamako, waving national flags and chanting slogans against France. Some of them have set fire to the French flag. They're angry with French interference in Mali's political affairs. They also want a total withdrawal of French troops from the country.
We are here for Mali. We are here to demonstrate our national sovereignty, to remind the whole world that sovereignty belongs to the people, and that today those who have not understood this must update themselves.
France, which is Mali's former colonial ruler, has over 5,000 troops there to help fight the resurgence of extremist groups. But many in Mali consider the mission a failure. Paris now plans to reduce the number of its military personnel in Mali to 3,000. The UN Special Representative in Sudan has urged the country's paramilitary forces to avoid confrontation during anti-coup protests scheduled for Saturday. The UN envoy made the call during a meeting with Rapid Support Force Chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. The capital Khartoum is bracing for major demonstrations on Saturday, following deadly clashes between security forces and protesters. At least 8 people have been killed and 170 others injured over the past days. Paramilitary and army forces have been deployed across Khartoum, as well as the twin cities of Khartoum North and Omdurman. The Sudanese military staged a coup on Monday and declared a state of emergency. The move has drawn international condemnation. Political commentator Julius Baluto says the Sudanese people are fed up with military coups in their country and want a democratic government.
Just like a Sudanese citizen, I can sense the undercurrent of politics there, whereby a lot of people, Sudanese, are yearning for change, and that change means democratic rule. Remember, Sudan has been there. 17 coups have been there in the country, some successful, others not. But it's time since independence of Sudan. It's about time when I think people think they've had enough of military coups, they just don't want it anymore. And I can see tomorrow a lot of determination on the streets of Sudan by the protesters. We are seeing right now a lot of protesters who led the revolution, which was hijacked by the military. Before, of course, the discussions, agreement for transitional government happened. We are seeing them coming back. Iconic figures, even ladies who are leading that revolution, are already, some of them are back. And definitely there will be change, because I see a situation whereby Sudanese are not relenting. They'll never stop until they get civilian leadership, democratic rule, because that's what they deserve.
The Canadian government has appealed a court ruling on individual welfare compensation to Indigenous children. Ottawa says it is instead working to strike a deal with indigenous groups by the end of the year. The government says it is putting the appeal on hold to start 2 months of talks from next week to negotiate a deal. Indigenous communities stressed that they would not leave out the issue of children's legal liabilities in the negotiations. The initial ruling required the Canadian government to pay billions of dollars to more than 55,000 Indigenous children. Ottawa appealed the ruling on Friday after a series of victories for Indigenous people in years-long legal battles. Indigenous Canadian communities are still reeling from recent discoveries of hundreds of unmarked graves of children at residential schools. International lawyer Barry Grossman says the Canadian government should make arrangements to compensate the Indigenous children instead of looking for ways to delay the payments.
The time to reach a negotiated resolution is before one party compels the other to make its case in court, and after a long, tedious, and expensive process, get a judgment. Frankly, I consider it a confirmation of the paternal attitude taken by the Canadian federal government towards Indigenous peoples. Something like $40,000 Canadian dollars was awarded to each of the affected children. They simply should make arrangements to pay it. I can't think of any reason why they would want to delay that. Excuse me. Let's be clear. The federal government in Canada says that it's willing to accept the judgment, that is to accept liability, but wants to negotiate the manner in which the money's paid because, in its opinion, it's inappropriate to have a sort of one-size-fits-all mentality. And while intuitively that makes some sense, in the sense that some people were no doubt more seriously affected than others, I doubt that that's what is motivating the federal government to take its position. Frankly, if that was an appropriate position to take, it could easily have been argued in court and the judgment structured around that.
Thousands of U.S.-bound migrants are advancing slowly in southern Mexico, rejecting an offer to receive provisional visas to stop their journey. The caravan is made up of about 3,000 migrants from Central America and the Caribbean, mostly women and children. They began their journey last week from the southern border in Mexico in a bid to reach the U.S. An advocate for the migrants said that they have been offered to dismantle the caravan in exchange for visas to settle provisionally in Mexico. However, most have rejected the offer. Washington has put pressure on Mexico to contain them before reaching the U.S. border. Previous caravans were confronted by migration agents and soldiers who are increasingly using tough tactics to stem the influx. Back to our story on Yemen, the advances of the army is the topic for this piece of news where Abdul Latif al-Bashali joins us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. So Abdul Latif, we do hear about these advances. Tell us about the most recent one, and tell us where things stand when it comes to the Marib governorate. I mean, at this point, how far has the army taken over? How much more territory is left?
Thank you so much. The Yemeni army managed this morning to take control of Umm Rij military camp. It's a strategic camp and it was very important. The Saudi led the coalition's forces. The Yemeni army has actually targeted this military camp with several times with ballistic missiles. It's a very important military camp as it overlooks the city of Marib. It is located further closer to the city of Marib. It's almost on the borders of Al Juba district. It is a major victory for the Yemeni army to take control of this camp. The Yemeni army continues advancing toward the city to liberate the city from the Saudi-backed forces. Actually, the forces of the Saudi Arabian coalition have received orders a few days ago to flee the city and to move toward Sayoun on east of Yemen. And this is also another indicate that the Yemeni army is really advancing on the ground, and the Saudi Arabian coalition have come to realize that they have lost this battle, and they know that it is a matter of time only until the Yemeni army liberates the whole province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces. Almost there are 12 directorates that have got liberated, and there is only one directorate, which is the city of Marib, and the Yemeni army is continuing its operations to liberate the city.
Thank you for that. Abdel Latif El-Washali there from Sana'a. Many thanks. Moving on, Iran has slammed U.S. sanctions targeting its drone program. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says the latest unilateral measures against Tehran shows Washington's contradictory behavior and proves that it is not trustworthy at all. The ministry spokesman says the current U.S. administration speaks of plans to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal, while in practice is following in the footsteps of the previous administration. Saeed Khatibzadeh says the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed to realize any of Washington's goals and will not succeed in the future either. Early on Friday, the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions on several companies and individuals connected to Iran's drone program. The U.S. Treasury claims that Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has supplied lethal UAVs to resistance movements in Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett says the U.S.'s policy of imposing sanctions against Iran is driven by the Israeli regime.
The important and the essential thing to understand in this policy is that this is not a policy of the American people. This is a policy of Israel and the Jewish-Israeli extremist Zionists, which have captured the American government to a large extent, the State Department, and the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Let's never forget that a dual Israeli citizen named Sigal Mandelker was the previous Office of Foreign Assets Control who put on sanctions against the New Horizons Conference when I was back in Iran with many other colleagues and academics and scholars. And it was this Sigal Mandelker, dual Israeli citizen, that orchestrated the arrest of Press TV journalist Marzia Hashimi and tried to extort her and engage in almost a torturous a cross-examination to try and somehow, get more information on Americans that were participating in this conference. So it's essential to combat this by declaring to the American people from Iran, from the Iranian leadership and the political figures, to declare to the American people, you are under siege. This is not the Biden administration's policy. This is Israel's policy and the Zionists that control the American government.
Cameraman of Iran's national television has survived an attempt on his life in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Ali Reza Sharifi was targeted with at least 7 bullets while driving. One of the bullets hit him in the face. He was accompanied by his wife and child when the attack took place. The assailants, who were riding on a motorbike, fled the scene after shooting him. No person or group has claimed the attack yet. At the moment, the Taliban have assumed responsibility for ensuring the cameraman's security. Sharifi has been working as the Iranian TV's local cameraman in Kabul for 10 years now. Leaders of the world's most advanced nations are arriving in the Italian capital, Rome, to attend the G20 summit there. Climate change, health, and the relaunch of the global economy tops the agenda of the two-day talks. The participants are under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. The event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders and global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatments.
About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city centre demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities' representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries, the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
France warns the UK that its international reputation is at stake in the Brexit disputes over fishing rights in Northern Ireland.
When you spend years negotiating a treaty, and then a few months later, you do the opposite of what was decided on the aspects that suit you the least, it is not a big sign of your credibility.
Emmanuel Macron made the remarks in an interview with Financial Times at a time of simmering tensions between Paris and London over fishing licenses. On Wednesday, France detained one British fishing boat and issued a warning to another in its waters. That is after London denied fishing licenses to boats from European Union nations, including France. And that is for World News.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. US President Joe Biden has moved to repair his damaged personal and political relationship with French President Emmanuel Macron by acknowledging that the announcement of a security and technology pact that blindsided France was a clumsy episode handled with a lack of grace. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Patrick Winter, Angelique Chisapis, and Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Biden Admits to Macron the US Was Clumsy in AUKUS Submarine Deal. President Joe Biden has moved to repair his damaged personal and political relationship with French President Emmanuel Macron by acknowledging that the announcement of a security and technology pact that blindsided France was a clumsy episode handled with a lack of grace. The U.S. President and his French counterpart met at France's Vatican Embassy in Rome, Italy, on Friday, 29th of October, ahead of the G20 Leaders Summit this weekend, for their first in-person discussion since an astonished Emmanuel Macron was left feeling betrayed and humiliated by last September's security deal. As a result of the AUKUS pact between the United States, Australia, and Britain, Australia tore up a troubled $66 billion contract signed with France to build six diesel-powered submarines in favor of a deal with the United States for eight nuclear-powered submarines. It was the first time the United States had offered to share its nuclear technology with a third party other than the United Kingdom. Sitting next to Emmanuel Macron before a bilateral meeting, Joe Biden also implied that he thought Australia had already informed France that it was cancelling its submarine contract. The answer is, I think what happened was, to use an English phrase, clumsy. It was not done with a lot of grace, Biden admitted. I was under the impression that France had been informed long before that the French deal was not going through, he said, which suggests either his staff failed to inform him or Australia misled the White House about what it had told the French. There is no suggestion from White House that Emmanuel Macron himself knew the contract had been cancelled, a point that the French have shown in published exchanges with the Australians days before the contract was cancelled. The two leaders met for nearly an hour and a half on Friday at the Villa Bonaparte, the French embassy to the Vatican. A senior U.S. official said that more than half of that time, Emmanuel Macron and Joe Biden were alone. It was a very meaty, substantive, but I would say broad-ranging and strategic conversation, a senior U.S. official said, adding that the leaders spent a fair amount of time talking about the challenge posed by the rise of China. I don't worry at all about instability or drift in the U.S.-France relationship, the official added, saying relations had been given a jolt of energy in the past month. We had some hard conversations back in September and October. I think the conversations heading into November will be exciting and engaging. There's not any sense that there's some kind of fundamental rift in the relationship. Leaders issued an unusually long joint statement after the meeting on Friday, highlighting areas of agreement. President Biden pledged to step up U.S. support for French efforts in the Sahel. The two leaders welcomed the establishment of a bilateral clean energy partnership by the end of the year. They affirmed their faith in NATO and its nuclear deterrent capabilities and robust collaboration in the Indo-Pacific region. Biden called France an extremely valued partner and a power in itself with the same values as the United States. Emmanuel Macron told reporters that the meeting had been helpful with a strong U.S. commitment about European defense, but he said what happened next was important. Trust is like love. Declarations are good, but proof is better, he said. The secretive handling of the submarine deal and the effective elbowing out of France from the Indo-Pacific region was in part driven by U.S. belief that France did not support a real confrontation with China. But the handling of the episode led to soul-searching in Washington and an acceptance it needed to do more than make gestures of reconciliation to President Macron. France regards the new agreement as necessary diplomatic and security recompense, and a successful effort to retrieve something positive from the debris of the cancelled Australian contract, which shook French trust in the Biden administration, symbolized by the temporary recall of the French ambassadors to both Washington and Canberra. Emmanuel Macron, in common with past French presidents, has long championed a stronger separate European defense identity that he says can be complementary and not duplicatory to NATO. But he has faced resistance from Germany and some Nordic European Union states that fear EU defense will mean losing the protection of the United States within NATO. An implicit Biden endorsement of the Macron project may help ease some of the objections inside the European Union, as well as play well for a U.S. domestic audience keen to reduce the global U.S. military footprint. Macron will develop the theme of a more autonomous European defense project as part of the six-month French presidency starting this January. Biden sees the shift as part of an effort to focus U.S. military resources on competing with the growing military strength of China in the Indo-Pacific region. Before the meeting, an Elysee source said, "It will be an occasion to show that after the AUKUS affair, we have been able to jointly negotiate significant elements of cooperation on key communal issues." The source in the Elysee said the meeting set a clear framework for future French-US relationship and set a very high level of ambition for relations between the European Union and the United States, with a strong emphasis on security and defense. The Elysee source said a key topic would be our common security, namely European defense and transatlantic defense ties. Macron's office stressed that there was no contradiction between European defense and the Atlantic Alliance, NATO. The Macron-Biden reconciliation, prepared in intensive talks over the last month, will help to heal some, but not all, of France's wounds, but still leaves untreated soured relations between France and Australia, including the issue of compensation to France for cancellation of the contract. France's relations with Britain are deteriorating separately across a range of largely Brexit rather than security-related issues. The AUKUS agreement is also facing growing questions in Australia, with some Australian politicians asking why Canberra has abandoned the certainty of purchasing French diesel-powered engines to become involved in buying nuclear-powered submarines that will be subject to an 18-month scoping study followed by a delay of decades.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazvi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Wade. The row between the UK and France continues over fishing rights. The UK says it reserves the right to respond in a proportionate way to France's detention of a British trawler in French waters. This is while France has said the boat detained lacked proper license. Paris has even threatened more measures, maybe even sanctions, if London denies fishing license to French boats operating in British waters. To explain first more about the developments on this story, Rob Carter is our correspondent, who joins us from London. Well, Rob, we've seen the heated words being exchanged here. Tell us the latest, if you can, on this.
This year, France could be slapping significant sanctions on the UK
sanctions could start off small, but France has also made clear that they're looking at a second round of sanctions if the first sanctions should happen to come into place and the UK still fails to change its policy regarding licenses for French fishermen to operate in disputed waters, waters which of course the UK lays claim to, but that France believes their fishermen should also have access to. This dispute may sound minor over fishing rights, but ultimately this is a territorial battle taking place between what's supposed to be two of Europe's biggest allies. And of course, this boils down to the aftermath of a very heated and contentious Brexit debate, which plagued relations between Britain and the continent for years and still continues to do so, but also the fact that relationship afterwards appears to have not repaired itself like many of the Brexiteers claimed that it would. In fact, there is a lot of resentment which still remains. This battle has been escalating. We've already seen British and French fishermen clashing their boats over disputed scallop fishing zones. We've actually seen security vessels dispatched to disputed zones in order to police the situation. And of course, now we are talking about potential sanctions being implemented. These sanctions are wide-ranging. They could affect extra checks on British trucks entering in and out of the Channel Tunnel, which of course would add to major delays and things like that. So economic consequences could hit Britain if they don't come to some kind of solution here. Britain, on the other hand, is under a lot of pressure. It's pitted against France on numerous issues, but ultimately the British electorate have essentially demanded from their government that they protect British borders, that they take a hardline stance against the continent, and ultimately that means that Boris Johnson can only compromise to such an extent before he'll start receiving criticism at home for being too weak. So what could happen is Britain and France could be forced in a situation where rather than the option of de-escalation is not an option, and they may have to keep battling it out to figure out who is more tougher and which ego is ultimately going to win this standoff.
Interesting way you're putting that. Thank you for that, Rob Carter. Let's introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have the former Member of Parliament of the United Kingdom, Derek Conway, who joins us from London. Also joining us is Chairman of the Board of BWA, Michael Schumann, who joins us from Verona.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and if I can start with our guest in Verona, Michael Schumann. What are we looking at here? Are we looking at something that's going to boil over, or our correspondent had a very interesting way of relaying the news, where he said that de-escalation is not an option, and we have to see whose ego is going to win.
Well, to let me put it bluntly, de-escalation must always be an option, because we can simply not afford in Europe to have this escalate further. Looking at this role, which your correspondent described rightly so, as a territorial battle, it doesn't come much as a surprise. I mean, of course, we all know how sticky, what a sticky point fishing rights Brexit negotiations. But underlying this, what we see right now is something that, you know, we predicted from the beginning of the Brexit discussion, that once you are willing to sacrifice European integration lightheartedly, old historical conflicts that haunted Europe in the past for quite a while, they will break up again. And this is what we're looking at right now. And this is something very, very disturbing.
Derek Conway, you heard our guest there. What are your thoughts about this in terms of basically ultimately coming down to who's right and who's wrong?
Well, I think it all seems quite childish. I'd like to be able to say to you that I think the British government is being very well behaved and honourable and good, and the French are just being stupid and unreasonable. But the fact is, both sides of this dispute are behaving in a very intemperate and silly way. The French really have got a very weak argument because over 98% of the fishing licenses have been issued, and that's presumably why the European Union is not getting involved, which it usually would. But by the same token, they're completely overreacting to the situation, and I think the British government probably just needs to talk it down a bit, because the French have got a very contentious election for the president coming up in the early part of next year, and that's going to make tensions very high as the country sort of swings to the right politically. And it's probably best for the British government to just try and calm things down a bit if it possibly can. But if the French are determined to be belligerent, then these aren't British waters, and therefore the French haven't got a strong case.
Well, what are we looking at in terms of the French statements here of what they're going to do? I mean, if we are going to take a look, Michael Schumann, at the French actions, it's going to involve sanctions, possibly. Are they going to go to that extent?
Possibly. I wouldn't rule it out. But even if they're not, you know, if you just look at the rhetoric that has been used these days, I mean, that's unbelievable. Would you have guessed that we see this kind of confrontation in the heart of Europe? Like the French European minister saying, we need to speak the language of force, the French threatening to cut off Jersey from electricity supplies in the middle of an energy crisis. I think, you know, no matter whether they move along with it, that belligerent as they have been or not, the fact that you hear this kind of rhetoric in the heart of Europe, that should really disturb us. And I, here in Verona, we've been at the Economic Eurasian Forum for the last 2 days discussing the state of the European Union, of European integration. And tell you something, I feel quite uneasy. As I said, these are old historical conflicts coming back up. And we give away that idea that European integration preserved peace too lightheartedly. With Brexit, but also now if you look at the Brussels stance on Poland or on Hungary, we play with fire here.
Okay, since we're talking about inflammatory statements, Derek Conway, let's take a look at Paris's warning that it could impose time-consuming, what it says, checks on all products and a ban on UK vessels from what we're seeing here, landing seafood at French ports. The UK, meanwhile, has said that aside from accusing France of inflammatory language, that did not rule out blocking French vessels from landing their catches in the UK. Who would suffer more economically here? I mean, could that speak as to which direction this is going to go?
I think, sadly, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, while the COP26 summit is going on in Glasgow this coming week, the British government will want to try and keep things calm until that's over. But the British are, by instinct, a belligerent people. And the French, for 1,000 years, have had unhelpful relations from time to time with the Brits and have always come off worse. And that's because Britain doesn't do well being bullied. The British people, by instinct, would be more than happy to take a hit economically, culturally, in every other respect if the French are pushing too hard. And so sometimes you have to take this sort of Gallic exuberance and diplomatically say, well, that's the French, that's how they behave, their arms are everywhere, they get excited over nothing, so it's just the French. But this could turn quite serious fairly soon, and I think in December December, if you see French ports being blocked, well, I think because of the European Union, you'll find Rotterdam is used more by those trying to gain access to the UK market. The French market with the UK is huge. Millions of French people live in Britain. Millions of Britons are tourists in France in usual circumstances, their largest group of visitors. And so this would harm both countries. But if that's how the French want to play it, then the instinct of my fellow countrymen to say is, if you're big enough, have a swing. And I think that's how it will go. It wouldn't surprise me at all if this deteriorates further over a relatively minor issue, really, and in the scheme of things. I mean, economically, fishing is not an important industry to Britain financially, but it is emotionally, and that's where the trouble comes.
Okay, I'm going to ask both of our guests here to maybe do something for us. So first, I'm going to start with you, Michael Schumann. Supposedly, there's going to be this meeting between the French President Emmanuel Macron and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Let's say that you, Michael Schumann, are the French President, and Derek Conway is the British Prime Minister, and you're getting together. What would you be telling him in order to de-escalate, as you said, it should go that route or not? What type of conversation would you have? Go ahead, Michael Schumann, you first. And Derek Conway in response to what he's going to ask you or say.
Well, that's quite difficult for me to answer because, as you know, I'm the board chairman of the German Industry Association, so I would probably recommend to call in Angela Merkel if she was still there to help and mediate, because it needs to be worked out. It needs to be de-escalated. We can't really say that de-escalation is not an option on the table. Both sides need to find a solution in the interest of stability in Europe in a very challenging time. I mean, we're looking at one of the worst challenges with the energy crisis that we have had in years, besides the pandemic. And I think this should not be on the table right now.
Derek Conway.
Well, Mr. President, I know you don't have a high regard for me as Prime Minister in Britain, and you think I'm a bit of a joker, and most of the time I am a bit of a joker. But on this, you had better understand that Britain is very serious indeed. And although you have a difficult election to face with the National Front in France, and I feel sorry for you that you have that challenge, but that won't affect the British position. You have French boats in British waters, and if you don't behave and comply with the rules, you can pull them out or we'll push them out.
Well, it looks like we can continue this. Go ahead, Michael Schumann.
Well, we have to see what happens to Article 16, right, of the Northern Ireland Protocol. From my assumption, is you're going to pull it, right? You don't want to have that anyway, so you're going to have a hard border in there, and that will further deteriorate the situation and prove to me that you have been playing false all along.
Right. So on a serious note here, Derek.
The issue of the Northern Ireland border is a matter for the European Union, and France has given up its competence and power to the European Union. It is no longer a sovereign nation. That's why Britain wanted to withdraw from the European Union, because we want to be in charge of our own destiny. And until the people of Northern Ireland decide they want to join up with ERA, they will remain part of the United Kingdom. It's called democracy, and if that's what they vote for, that's what they get. At the moment, they say they want to stay part of the UK, so as Prime Minister of the UK, the job is to make sure that happens, and no amount of French arm waving will change that situation. You're conflating two different issues, and one is directly with France, and we understand where that difference lies, and we will not be pushed around.
Michael Schumann.
It's hard to me. I mean, I don't play the French role very convincingly, probably. But as I said, I'd rather look at it from a German perspective.
Okay.
And
the Germans
and,
are too reasonable. You don't wave your arms around enough.
Well, let me ask you.
But that is what you need. You need a reasonable approach to that. Right. Takes the emotions out of it. Takes the historical connotations out of it. And find a solution where both sides can preserve their face and still de-escalate the situation. I simply refuse.
But politics is an emotional business. I spent 33 years an elected politician, and it is a
politician.
That's what Chancellor Merkel didn't understand when the Prime Minister of Britain, Mr. Cameron, said, I need to do something about immigration levels in Britain, and if I don't, we're going to lose. Angela Merkel said, no, you will not lose it. The Brits are not going to vote to leave the European Union. Well, she got that call wrong. So sometimes being clinical and calm can backfire if you don't understand the emotion behind someone's political position. And the Brits, as I say, can be a belligerent nation, but surprisingly, they're quite an emotional nation too. They may not demonstrate it, but it's just under the surface, and when it bubbles out, it's very difficult to get back into the bottle.
Okay, I've got to squeeze this question in here. Michael Schumann, if I may. I'm looking at the Ireland's EU Affairs Minister, Thomas Byrne, Michael Schumann, who has tweeted in solidarity with Paris, quote, the partnership between France and Ireland through Brexit has been strong. The trade and cooperation agreement is clear. Vessels fishing in traditional waters should be allowed to continue. So is the EU taking the side of France in this case?
Well, France is still a member of the EU, and of course they're closer to us now than it's the UK, but it wouldn't be wise to exasperate the situation. And let me just give one more reply to the gentleman on the other side. I've been witnessing Angela Merkel for 16 years, and I've never seen a politician as unemotional. There were only two times where her emotions filled decisions. There was on the migration issue, the energy, and you can reasonably view that these were worse decisions. So I would still advocate for a reasonable and calm approach to this.
Okay.
I think the position of the ERA commentary from Southern Ireland is understandable, but it's not the European Union. The European Union speaks on trade matters and on fishing agreements, and the European Union has said it's not just about the permit, it's about whether you qualify for a permit. And the handful of French fishing vessels who've been so far excluded from British waters have been excluded because they do not qualify under the permit arrangement. So if somehow they can find the documents to show they fished in these waters only one day a year for the past 6 years, only one day, not a whole week or a whole month, then they would get their permits. But because they can't comply with the paperwork that the EU has said they must under the agreement, then that's where the problem lies. So the noise is off from Southern Ireland, from any other country, individually don't really matter. The European Commission is the one who is the guardian of this agreement, and that's why they're keeping well out of this little fight.
Okay, I'd like to get to the worst case and the best case scenario. Best case scenario, problem will be solved. Okay, worst case scenario, we talked about blockades here, and the fears of it prompted Prime Minister Boris Johnson to send two Royal Navy gunboats to the area. This much we know. And then France sending two of its own coastal patrol vessels before the French trawlers retreated. Michael Schumann, do you think that, what does that show? I mean, does that take it to another level, that there's going to be some kind of clash there, perhaps?
No, I refuse to believe that. I simply cannot imagine that we see a form of armed conflict over such an issue. But it is language of force. And even if it stays that way, it's quite disturbing, as I repeatedly said. And it is these kinds of conflicts that we once thought we had dealt with in Europe, and we will not see them again. And what the British and the French are experiencing, the Germans and the Poles could experience in the future, it's not good to see those demons from the past being let loose again and have this kind of confrontations. That didn't end well in the middle of the 20th century. And we're in a situation, in geopolitical and global situation right now, where our priorities should lie elsewhere.
Okay. And Derek Conway, what would prompt this to be resolved? What moves needs to be taken from one side or the other, or mutually, in order for this to progress onto the positive aspect?
Well, I understand that Department in Britain and the part of the EU Commission that deals with this are trying desperately hard to help these smaller fishermen, French fishermen, comply with the permit regulations. And if they can do that, they'll get the permit, and then hopefully everyone can be happy. If they can't, then they either tear up the agreement, or the fishermen are not allowed to fish in British waters. The British Royal Navy is there to defend British shipping and British waters. So if we see the violence that happened last time from some of the French fishing industry, which can get a little out of hand from time to time, when some of the fishing boats from Jersey were attacked physically, then of course the Royal Navy should intervene and try and prevent that, as should French boats, actually, because they're there to keep the peace and maintain harmony on the waves. So I hope it won't get to that, but you could see it happening. And that's the danger of all the rhetoric that's going on. So hopefully let's see these small fishermen get their permits and they can go on doing their small fishing, because it means nothing to the whole nation of France and it means nothing to the whole nation of Britain economically, but emotionally it clearly means a great deal. And armed conflict has come from far lesser things, so I hope it won't spiral to that, but you couldn't say it's impossible.
Okay, we'll end it there. Thank you, Derek Conway. Very good to see you, Derek Conway there, former member of the Parliament of the United Kingdom, and Michael Schumann, thank you, Chairman of the Board of BWA, who spoke to us from Verona. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatlay, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. I am Musa al-Bahadili, and joining me in the studio today is our dear friend Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid.
Thank you for inviting.
Our question today is as follows. It is actually quite relevant, especially today with all these feminist movements and equal rights and so on and so forth. So the question is as follows. Is it not wrong to use women as tools? Why then does Allah in heaven make use of women using the term Huris in such a manner?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the first part is right, that it is not right and good to use women as tools. When we talk about the using women as a tool, we generally refer to what's happening in today's world.
Right.
You know, the women are the main part of advertisement. If you want to advertise even a pamper, a t-shirt of a male, you need
right.
a woman next to a male, half
right.
naked or something like that.
You need to appeal
so that
to the men.
Yes. So even when you go to an office, the secretary should be a woman. I don't know, there are the air hostesses.
Right.
Anywhere where you go, you see a woman being used as a tool, which is not right. Islam has given respect to the woman, an equal respect as there is a man. And the respect of a woman is even more important than a man in some verses and the narrations that we have from the Prophet.
The dignity, especially.
The dignity, the status of a woman,
right.
being a mother, a nurturer, a trainer, the one to whom you can, you know, on whom you can trust and leave your kids. And these are the things that are mentioned in the Quran and in the narration.
Right, it's not just a purely physical and pleasing figure then.
No, it's not just that. On the other hand, there's a, you know, Islam talks about the equality. For example, if I talk about the man and woman, for the husband and wife, we have a verse libasun lahun wa libasun lakum. That you are, they are your clothes and you are their clothes.
Right.
For husband and wife. That, you know, when I wear a cloth, I'm very much careful about it. It does not become dirty. When
right.
I eat something,
you
I do
take
not.
Take care of it.
Yes, I do not, put anything. I try to keep it safe from being, you know, dirty, being from being,
right.
you know, misused.
Right.
Even the clothes that I like, I never share it, even with my brother or father.
You take extra special care.
Yes. You know, if I have a suit or, I don't know, a special cloth, which I love. So, similarly, it's on the other hand as well. Like, if a woman has a dress, she takes care of it and
right.
all those things. On the other hand, this cloth, it hides the faults or, you know, the it hides my, basically, errors and faults, we can say.
Right.
If I have anything which is needed to be hidden, I use my clothes to hide it.
Right.
Even if a person is, you know, having a good gesture, even the cloth helps it to hide it so that everyone cannot approach it. It protects from different types of weathers. You know, we have
right.
cold and we have hot weather.
Naturally, yeah.
Clothes saves us. So when it talks about the equality, it talks about both parts, that they are your clothes, you're their clothes. So Allah gives this example.
Right.
There are many places in the Quran where it is said, mu'minin, mu'min and mu'minat, mu'minin wal mu'minat. They both will go to the paradise,
right.
the believing men and believing women. Now what happens is basically, there's a general mistake which is done in the translations is that because we do not understand the Arabic language, the adabiyat-i Arab, we say, Arabic grammar or literature,
right.
we are not familiar with the tone, with the, you know, idioms that are used in that language. Therefore, we make mistakes while translating Quran. In the Arabic language or literature, we see when there is a mixed gathering, a masculine verb is used, or a
right.
masculine noun. For example, if there are believing men and believing women, the word mu'minin is used. For example, ya ayyuhan nas, o mankind.
And it is inclusive of
yes.
both genders.
It's it includes both genders,
right.
all of them. For example, let me give you a simple example. The simplest example is when we meet someone, what do we say? Assalamu alaykum.
Kum. Right.
Okay. Kum means you all. It's
right.
a masculine pronoun. Whereas for the feminine pronoun, we use ki.
Right.
We do not say assalamu alayki, okay, or assalamu alaykunna.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So
that would be weird.
Yeah, that would be weird. So we use assalamu alaykum, peace be upon you all, and we do not say men, because if literally we translate this, the literal
right.
translation of assalamu alaykum is peace be upon you all men.
And that would be the translation of somebody who does not know the etiquette
yes.
of the Arabic language.
The one who does not know the etiquettes or the idioms or the way this language has been used, they will literally translate it as peace be upon you all men.
Then we have a new problem, like Islam only says hello to men.
Yes, Islam always says hello to men and not the women. So therefore,
yeah.
even when we see a woman or, you know, you see a female, you say assalamu alaikum.
Right.
And they even, like the women's to each other, even if they're Arab, they don't say assalamu alayki.
No.
Even
no.
in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, I don't know, Syria, you just count the names of the countries, go and see how ladies meet each other. They say
right.
assalamu alaikum. So the woman is, a lady is saying,